Good morning, and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policies Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director. We are normally joined here by Frank Mard, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute. Unfortunately, Frank can't be with us here this morning, and we will miss him. But we're glad you can join us here on The People's Business as we try to, our best to cast a little sunshine on the ways in which government is doing and or not doing the people's business. So later in today's program, we're going to be speaking with Jimmy Vilkind. He's the Albany Bureau Chief of Capital New York. You all know him. Capital New York's a publication which, in its own words, is for and about the people and institutions that shape New York, delivering fast, original, essential analysis and reporting on city and state politics and the media industry. I would say that's a pretty accurate description of what they do. Wonderful publication. But before we hear from Mr. Vilkind, we're pleased to be joined on the telephone by Andrew Pallotta. He's the Executive Vice President of NYSET. He's going to be joining us in just a few minutes. And NYSET's a federation of more than 1,200 local unions, which all told represents more than 600,000 people who work in or retired from the New York schools, colleges, and healthcare facilities. So we'll be talking to Andy in just a minute. But before we do, I just wanted to catch up with Brian a little bit. Brian, I don't know if you realize this, but things have been going on in Albany. There's been some changes.
I didn't know that. I thought things were relatively quiet.
Yeah, I mean, it's the year of falling leaders, it seems like.
It's unprecedented. It's a seismic shift in power in Albany. So back in January, the longtime Speaker of the Assembly, Shelley Silver, was arrested and then indicted. And then after some back and forth, decided to give up his position as Speaker. And we've all been sort of dealing with that. And then yesterday, Dean Skelos, who's been leader of the Senate Republicans since 2008, bowed out of that position. He's going to stay in the Senate and help keep Republicans in the majority. But he bowed out to his handpicked successor, John Flanagan, who we had on this show just a few months ago.
Right. And it seemed like, unfortunately or fortunately for some, Senator DeFrancisco didn't make the cut. I mean, it seemed like the two of them were really vying for the position in a very cordial way, I guess. I think they did a good job of not making it an ugly show in Albany, which it often can be. So I commend both men for their fortitude, but... Why do you think Flanagan came out on top on this?
Well, it's a fascinating situation. So, you know, Skelos has been he was the deputy leader of that conference since 1995. So this is someone who's been in power or waiting to be in power for a long, long time. When Senator Bruno moved off the scene, Senator Skelos from Long Island, it marked a big shift to have not an upstate leader, but a Long Island leader, a downstate leader in that body. His number two, Tom Libous, Senator Tom Libous from Binghamton, is an upstater. But Senator Libous is also under federal indictment right now, and he's also battling cancer. So he's been receiving treatment in Florida and has really not been around very much this session. Senator DeFrancisco, the number three Republican, who's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, was seen by many as a favorite to take over the position. And I think when the scandal broke last week, really sort of started... supporting Senator Skelos, but when it became clear that he couldn't stay in that position, two camps clearly lined up. One was the upstate camp, and one was the Long Island camp. Senator Flanagan starts with 9 votes. He only needs 16 to be leader in the Senate conference, and we had a very active weekend of lots of phone calls and lots of meetings and a lot of back and forth. At one point, Senator Skelos said he wasn't going to leave at all, and that if he was deposed as leader, he would leave the body, which would be depriving Republicans of the needed 32 votes. Quickly backed off that, apparently, and then threw his support behind Flanagan and said that he would leave if Senator Flanagan took the position. So there's been a lot going on in the last 48 hours.
Yeah, it's been amazing to watch. I mean, it seems like this never-ending cycle, though. I mean, you know, two out of the three men in the room are now been taken out by Preet, and everybody's wondering when the next shoe is going to drop or if it's going to drop. But I think given the fact if you look at what happened to Senator Skelos with wiretapes and things like that, where the folks from Glenwood Management and were cooperating with the federal prosecutor here. I mean, it's just amazing to think about who else may be worried in Albany, right? I mean, so many people have had dealings with this particular lobbyist for Glenwood, and the fact that he had been wearing a wire, I'm sure, is troubling to a lot of folks in this town.
Well, that's the joke in Albany, right? You have a conversation with someone, you say, are you wearing a wire? Right. You know, what's interesting is that, so you mentioned Preet Bharara down in New York City, who back in January, when he went after the speaker, said, stay tuned. Right. And people are reading the tea leaves, and they don't know exactly how far that goes. But in the meantime, you know, you had a longtime Assemblyman Bill Scarborough from Queens, who was, you know, kind of humdrum stuff of just abusing right. his per diems and saying he was in Albany when he wasn't. That would have been big news a few years ago. Now it barely went by without a ripple at all in the Albany pond. So yeah, there's a lot of things happening in Albany, and again, we don't know how high it's going to go. Right. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Things are changing. So, joining us on the phone. Okay. Well, we will be joined on the phone momentarily by Andy Pallotta. We could continue to have this conversation all day, you and I, I'm sure, because the dynamics in Albany have changed quite a bit. I mean, I guess I wonder what's going to happen now as a result of all this. You know, what's going to happen at the end of this session? I know I've been pushing issues like property tax relief, and clearly that is not on the table. Nobody's talking about it. You know, I don't know if Senate Republicans are now going to start talking about it again. They have their own proposal, but it's been pretty quiet.
What I keep hearing is it's going to be very quiet. So we've got 6 weeks left, or maybe 5 weeks left until the end of session, and there are a lot of big issues on the table. You know, the last time we spoke, we were just finishing up with the budget negotiations, and things like charter schools and tax credits for private schools, rent control in New York City, mayoral control for schools in New York City and possibly upstate cities. These big issues are still sort of hanging out there, whether or not we're going to have an extender for the state property tax cap. There are a lot of big issues still on the table. The question is, what's going to happen?
Yep. And a lot of these issues affect our friends in the education field. So toward that end, we are lucky enough to be joined by Andrew Pallotta, the Executive Vice President at NYSET. Andy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Good morning. This is Brian McDonald. I'd like to welcome our guest, Andy Pallotta, to the People's Business here on WRPI Troy. A longtime elementary school teacher and grassroots union leader, Andy Pallotta was elected Executive Vice President of NYSET in 2009, where his responsibilities fall for taking care of political mobilization and legislative efforts. Our main topics for today are the long list of education measures that were recently enacted along with New York State's 2015-16 budget and NYSET's priorities for the rest of the year. But before we dig into we have a lot to talk about. Before we dig into that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in union activities and overseeing NYSET's political and legislative affairs?
Sure. Well, I taught for about 25 years, just short of 25 years, got involved in the union because I felt that there was a definite need for a voice for educators, and I found that the union was able to provide that voice. Got a position as a chapter leader in the building, worked my way up to a district rep in the West Bronx, and then a few years ago, had the opportunity to run for office here for the statewide union, NYSET.
Yeah, well, we're glad you did. You've certainly done a lot for NYSET, and you've been an active advocate, to say the least, on education issues. But I wanted to ask you, Andy, last Friday, NYSET announced a plan for activity and advocacy designed to inspire lawmakers to help educators reclaim the joy of teaching and learning. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Reclaim the Joy campaign and NYSET's priorities for the remainder of the 2015 regular legislative session, which is scheduled to finish on Wednesday, June 17th. Although, given the way things are going, I think that could potentially change. From what I'm hearing, these guys are looking to get out of town as quickly as possible. I don't know what you're hearing. But maybe you can tell us a little bit about Reclaim the Joy campaign and where that's going.
Sure. Well, what we had was a very difficult budget cycle, especially for NYSET, because of some of the programs that the governor put into the budget. One of them that came out of the budget and we're trying to reclaim the joy on is one of those things is don't hold school aid hostage, which we mean don't hold the money that is coming to schools that they need so desperately hostage because of you're coupling it with the new APPR system that the governor wanted to put into place. So what we're saying there is there are some pretty ridiculous deadlines that have been placed in this bill for the APPR, for the teacher evaluation piece. And we're saying schools need a long time to get it right. So they need at least until September 2016 to make sure that the APPR, the evaluation system, actually makes sense. Obviously, a lot of people didn't agree with that, and we have the situation that we have now. So instead of just jumping in and doing an evaluation system without dealing with all the factors that go into that would be a problem. So that's one way of reclaiming the joy. Another is repealing outside evaluators. That would be mandatory because, as was seen at the Learning Summit held by Chancellor Tisch in the Regents last week, we see that a lot of folks really don't even understand how you get outside evaluators to come in. As in any profession, we should be held accountable and we should seek to the highest professional abilities that we have. But putting something like an outside evaluator in some of the school districts around the state really makes very little sense. When an outside evaluator may be coming from a faraway distance, and if they're a principal in another school district, now who's the principal in that school? But what we have here is a lot of questions. There were some ideas that were thrown out. So we're saying this thing doesn't really make that much sense, so let's work on it, and we need the regents and the chancellor and the legislature to see how we can work this out.
I want to talk about that outside evaluator situation as well, as a follow-up. So one of the provisions in the budget had to do with failing schools being put under receivership. And my read of this looked like it was very damaging to teachers, that their collective bargaining rights were attacked, that, in fact, up to 50% of teachers in a failing school can be removed from the position. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the highlights or the lowlights of the education policy changes?
Sure. I think it's mostly lowlights because I don't think we really had folks drafting this legislation, putting this out there that really understand what it's like to work in a struggling school. And just to highlight that, they put it out as failing schools. And failing schools just labels schools, right? So there have been some changes put in by Kathy Nolan and Senator Flanagan to address that and say it's struggling schools. So what we have is let's give these schools the time they need to succeed. So the provision should give them at least a year to get this into place. There was money put into this, but we want to see that money at the front end, not letting a school go 6 to 9 months before they actually receive the money that would help them. And the bigger picture here is we see the schools that are struggling, and how do you recruit and how do you retain the best educators when you're saying to them, well, you know, 50% of you may be let go at the end of the year? That is just a ridiculous, ridiculous way of running a school system where you would say, you're in a struggling school, we want you to work really hard, but if it doesn't work out this year, then we're going to get rid of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
how do you do that when you have high turnover rates and so many issues that the families and the students and the educators are dealing with? You're putting an unsurmountable amount of pressure on people.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And I think the other thing that never gets considered is the fact that these quote-unquote failing schools all have pretty common characteristics in terms of the socioeconomics of the communities surrounding them, right? I mean,
right.
The majority of the kids are in free and reduced-price school lunch. 9 out of 10 are minorities, 3 times more likely to be living in poverty. A lot of them have English as a second language barrier. So, you know, if we don't deal with those kind of external issues, you know, you're not going to be able to help children learn effectively. You know, if children coming to school hungry, you know, living in poor families, I mean, you know as well as I do, these are the hardest students to educate. And certainly not to say that it can't be done. It obviously can be done. But I think, you know, we're blaming the schools for socioeconomic problems that are outside their control. And to blame teachers for that and to hold them accountable, you know, by way of full disclosure, my wife is a middle school teacher. And she gets so frustrated because you have, you know, these politicians that have never been in a classroom, don't understand teaching, creating education policy in kind of a vacuum. So I'm sure that frustrates you as well.
Well, it frustrates me personally because I worked in a struggling school in New York City and saw the amount of pressure that was placed on us with the testing. So we talk about a test prep culture and an obsession. Work in a struggling school, and then you really see it firsthand. So what we have is, we do have a couple of ideas on this, and one is Crystal People Stokes has put forward a community schools piece of legislation that would provide a wraparound group of services that students can take advantage of, and educators also in a school that is struggling. So you have many more after-school programs. I mean, you have schools in areas around the state that just don't have the facilities that other schools have, and we talk about equality in this state so much, and yet you'll see one school district spending $8,000 plus more per student than another school district. So if you're looking from the outside, you say, well, maybe if we equalize that and we gave $8,000 more per student to this school district so they can have all the programs and services that the other district has, maybe they would be doing better. And by working in a struggling school and seeing that it can be turned around with the right amount of resources, I know that we can get this job done.
It seems to me that the solution doesn't deal with the actual problems, right? So that we've talked about that. And we've talked about that on the show before, the demonization of teachers. If I were, you know, one of the best and brightest coming out of college right now and I wanted to make teaching my career, I think there would be a real disincentive to teach in a place like the Bronx where they need the best and the brightest and the energy and the enthusiasm. It just seems like misguided public policy to me.
Right. We've seen that the amount of young people going into education has gone down. In New York State alone, we've seen a 22% drop in enrollment in education programs. And we've been watching this with our friends at SUNY. So what we have here is you're making folks that want to do this, that have this calling, think twice, because you're just making it so frustrating for them. Because they see folks that are in the field already, and they say, do I really want to put myself through that, through a time where politicians are looking for a scapegoat, looking for someone to blame, and it's ridiculous. They blame the actual people who are trying to make things better. It's like blaming the nurse or the doctor for a patient that is very sick. Well, you need them in that room so they can get better. It seems so simple.
So, Andy, where does this all come from? Back in October, the governor, it was widely reported that the governor had said that he wanted to break what he considered the only remaining public monopoly. I mean, that's pretty strong stuff. Can you talk a little bit about the motivation behind the attack on public education?
Well, I think the governor's statement about breaking the monopoly really just made it very clear what his educational agenda was. So what we have is the union gives voice to the educators. It's why I got involved in the union, because I felt that now I have a voice. I can speak freely about issues and feel that the union has my back. When the governor came out with his list of proposals, I don't think any of them really said, let's make the schools better. What I think he did was he put forward a program of, let's get people nervous about schools. Let's make them think schools are failing. This way they'll follow what I'm saying, which is let's put schools into receivership. Let's tie the evaluation piece to the money. So many ridiculous themes throughout his budget process. We do thank the legislature for pushing back on many of those. But we just see that you cannot have all of his proposals in an education package that even Chancellor Tisch has said we can't possibly put all these into a program by the end of this school year and then have school districts look at this and come out with an evaluation system. It just doesn't make sense. When you're dictating from the top, you don't really know or have a knowledge of the field. We've said it time and time again. Governor Cuomo, come to our schools. See what's really going on. Maybe you'll make some friends. Maybe being in a school, you'll be able to see what the educators are doing, what the SRPs are doing, the teachers. And he could take some pride in the amount of work and dedication that we see in the schools every day.
Yeah, there's no question that I think that would help broaden his view of education and educators, for that matter.
Right.
We could maybe take a week's vacation and spend it teaching around the state. That'd be interesting.
That sounds like a theme.
Andy, I got to ask you, I mean, obviously, you know, big changes in the Senate yesterday. Senator Skelos is no longer majority leader. Senator John Flanagan is now in charge. He's the former education chair. Is that good news? Is that bad news for education? Where do you think this is going? How are you feeling about this change in leadership?
Well, I think change is good. And I think Senator Flanagan knows our issues. We've been speaking with him for years on these issues. He understands. He also hears directly from his constituents what they want from schools, how their priority is great schools in their districts. So I think Senator Flanagan taking over the lead is a good thing. I also think we look at leadership as a whole and what the Wall Street Journal, NBC4, Marist poll just came out with about the popularity of the governor and how only 37% approve of where he's going. So I think between Speaker Hastie's, now Leader Flanagan, we can start seeing some movement in the right direction in this state, especially in the field of education, which is, of course, my top priority.
So you mentioned polling. During the budget fight, there was a well-publicized round of polling about the governor's proposals pitting him against the teachers. And it was pretty clear that public opinion is on the side of the teachers. So what do you think, what does that mean moving forward? It looks like the teachers are helping to reclaim the public narrative about the importance of the job they do. So are you optimistic? Do you sort of still feel like you've got a battle ahead?
I am an optimist.
In this business, you have to be.
How can you not be, right? I mean, come on.
And you just have to be in this field.
Glasses half full.
That we are in a battle, but we do have the public with us. They want great schools. They understand what great schools need. And I believe that the poll that was done putting the educators over the governor as far as education mm-hmm. policy in this state really makes it very clear that they understand, and it's not just rhetoric of we're number one in spending and we don't get our results. I mean, he's said that so many times it's boring to even listen to that. So we believe that when we talk about equity in this state and we start putting the same resources into low-income districts as we do into high-income districts, we will see this state move in the right direction. So hopefully that's where we're going.
Right. Let me ask you this, Andy. I mean, one of the other issues that impacts education is certainly the 2% property tax cap. That is going to be up for reauthorization. I mean, it's not technically up for reauthorization until June of 2016, but it has been seemingly inextricably linked to the rent regulations bill, which expires in mid-June as well, of this year. So do you think we're going to see any changes to the tax cap? I mean, I'm not a betting or gambling man, but I'd have to say chances are it's probably going to be reauthorized. So I'm wondering, are there any changes you want to see to it that you think would help? I mean, certainly this tax cap has been One of the things that's really strangling education funding, certainly at the local level, and you know, nobody likes to see their property taxes go up, but when you institute a property tax cap and cut education funding at the state level, it's really been a recipe for disaster for schools. So I'm wondering what changes you might want to see in the tax cap and whether or not you think that might happen.
Right. You're so right. Having budget cuts and a tax cap at the same time was a disaster for the schools. And the governor putting that forward during that time showed a great insensitivity to how schools operate. One of the things that we'd like to see is are some exemptions from the tax cap. And this year for enrollment growth would be a great place for us to start with the exemptions. When you have school districts where more and more students are coming in, and yet you still have the same amount of money, anyone would see that that is a bad business model. You have to be able to raise more money if you have more students. And there are districts around the state with the young people that are coming in and they're unaccompanied minors. This is a real problem when there's young people coming into a school system and there's no more money coming in. Allowing a school district to have more local control is crucial in this state. I know the concept of a tax cap seems good. People hear tax cap. Good. I don't want to pay more taxes. But yet, I want to say I have great schools where I live. So there has to be some more amount of local control so that the voters would have an equal say. And of course, on that, where we say what we feel is an unconstitutionality of the voting that takes place and going above the cap, we believe it should be one person with one vote and not have a supermajority, which we've been fighting for years. So at least those two changes to the tax cap would be very beneficial.
Among other things that are being discussed between now and the end of session are charter schools. And the governor tried to increase the cap of charter schools in the budget, was not able to get it during budget negotiations. This is going to be a big topic moving forward. Just a few days ago, Senator Klein put in a proposal to force the mayor of New York to have a charter school representative sitting on his board of people who help control the Board of Education in New York City. So clearly the charter school movement is not going anywhere fast. What do you think the prospects are for the expansion of charter schools between now and the end of June?
Well, I think, of course, there will continue to be a large push. I mean, we look at the amount of political contributions that went from the charter industry into the coffers of many campaigns. So they are looking for that cap to rise. We also say there needs to be clear accountability, financial accountability by the charter schools. So when we see that Comptroller Dinopoli is trying to make it very clear and do the audits, and there's so many problems coming along with doing that, we say, why would we want to raise the cap when the amount of schools that you already have are not being held financially accountable to the public?
Well, this is the People's Business on WRPI in Troy, and we've been speaking with Andrew Pallotta, the executive vice president of NYSET, the New York State United Teachers, which is a federation of more than 1,200 local unions, which all told represent more than 600,000 people who work in or are retired from the New York schools, colleges, health and healthcare facilities. Andy, we could talk to you all day, I think, on these issues. We really appreciate you coming on the show today and taking the time to speak with us this morning. So,
thank you very much. Appreciate it here, too.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Andy. We're going to take a quick break for station identification purposes on WRPI in Troy, and we'll be right back with Jimmy Vilkind.
Mom, thanks for taking me to work with you today.
It's my pleasure, honey.
Gee, you work with lots of people who don't look like you at all.
What do you mean?
Well, there are Asian people and African Americans and Latinos and...
Of course there are. Here, we all work together as a team.
But aren't they different than you are?
In a way, but those differences are good because they mean different ways of seeing things, different ways of thinking things, and different ways of doing things.
But Mom, if all that different stuff is so good where you work, how come where we live, everyone looks just like us?
Diversity shouldn't be left behind at work each day. In our neighborhoods, it can create a greater appreciation and respect for cultural differences and prepare our children for the global life that lies ahead. After all, your family doesn't live in a 9-to-5 world. Why should diversity?
Mom, the people you work with are awesome. I really like them.
To better understand the benefits of diversity in your community, log on to aricherlife.org. That's www.aricherlife.org. A message brought to you by the National Fair Housing Alliance in celebration of the 40th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act.
Hello, this is Mark O'Connor. And when I'm in Troy, I listen to WRPI Troy.
And hi, welcome back to The People's Business on WRPI in Troy, 91.5 FM. Or you can listen to us live on the web at www.wrpi.org. So we hope you're listening around the state and in the Capital District. We're going to be joined in just a minute by Jimmy Vielkind, who is the Albany Bureau Chief for Capital New York, which is going to be making some changes very soon as well, which Jimmy's going to be telling us a little bit about. But I wanted to take a minute to continue my conversation with Brian and kind of follow up on some of the things Andy was saying. You know, the property tax gap is not only affecting teachers, it's affecting local employees around the state. Obviously, local municipalities are covered by the tax gap as well. And they've been having some really hard times. Clearly, we've laid off tens of thousands of state and local employees across the state, doing everything from plowing roads to providing care for the elderly in nursing homes. Obviously, state and local employees provide a wide array of services for members and residents in New York State. So I'm wondering, Brian, you know, the reauthorization of the tax cap impacts a lot of the folks that you represent as well. So where are you guys on that right now?
Well, look, since the tax cap went into effect in 2010, there has been a serious strain on public services. And, you know, you mentioned just a few of them, but education is involved, public safety is involved, fire and police protection are involved, those potholes in the roads and the bridges that we all drive over. You know, one of the big themes this year in the budget conversation was infrastructure. Well, the infrastructure has been starved because local government no longer has the finances to pay for everything. So it's this narrative that you should shrink the size of government, but people still need to maintain those public services. So, you know, when the property tax cap went into effect, it was sort of like the perfect storm. There had been some real problems on Wall Street in the Great Recession, which caused pension costs to spike at the same time that the public coffers were being drained because there just wasn't a lot of revenue coming in. And then at that same time, the governor was also pushing an austerity policy, pumping very little money into state into local governments. So it's been this sort of three-prong attack on local governments, and they've been starved.
Right. And local government's been calling for mandate relief as well. Right. They're forced to make payments for Medicaid, one of the few states in the country that actually requires a local match for Medicaid from counties. So that's kind of a different approach than many other states and does put a big burden on counties to, you know, levy the taxes to provide those services at the local level. You know, a lot of people have called for the state to take over the local portion of Medicaid, like many other states do. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Obviously, there's a lot of money attached to that as well. But I know one of the other issues I just wanted to touch on for a second here is the fact that Cardinal Dolan is in Buffalo right now with the governor, and they're talking about the education investment tax credit, something that I feel is just honestly an abysmal piece of tax policy in that It provides a 75 to 90% tax credit to people, oftentimes wealthy individuals or large corporations that make contributions to education scholarship funds or to public schools in certain instances, or charter schools in the Senate version of this bill. But they provide scholarships for children and families with incomes up to $550,000. So they're doing all this under the guise of helping poor children. And I have to say that this is one of the things that really gets under my skin when I see this type of tax policy being pushed. I think that the vast majority of private and public school students or parents out there that are paying for these services don't realize that this is not going to benefit them. They're not going to get a break on their tuition or anything like that, that this just simply creates scholarship funds and in some instances creates scholarship funds for children in wealthy families. So I've got a real problem with this.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because we've talked about this issue on the show before, and the Cardinal really has been the front man for this conversation and this narrative. And when the EIITC was not included in the budget, the Cardinal was very angry and said that there will be repercussions. There's talk about handing out leaflets and flyers at Sunday Mass. You know, but the story behind the story is what you alluded to, which is that it's not struggling families who are sending their kids to Catholic schools who are going to benefit from this tax giveaway. It's the wealthy, and it's people who go to these uber-private, expensive academies and boarding schools, and it's the same hedge fund people that are trying to weaken public education overall who are going to benefit from this. So it's interesting to see the Catholic Church taking up this battle when it's not really their constituents who are going to benefit from this kind of tax cut, this tax policy.
Yeah, it does. It does seem strange. It seems like the message they're pushing is really not that the same message of the bill itself. So I'm a little perplexed by it as well. And I guess I'm also troubled by the fact that, you know, I'm concerned that Catholic Charities is, you know, potentially going to suffer from this too, because, you know, with the education tax credit, the tax advantages are so great. I mean, a 75 to 90% tax credit, it's just staggering to think about. So a lot of folks are going to be getting very big and very large tax credits for that in and of itself, I mean, it's anywhere from 15 to 34 times the benefit for giving through the education tax credit than you would get for normal charitable contributions. So that's a problem as well.
Well, it's also part of this sort of multi-prong attack on public education. So it was interesting to see the Cardinal really calling out NYSET, the State Teachers Union, after the budget fight, and really sort of going after teachers. And, you know, one of the things that we did talk about a little bit with Andy was the charter school industry. And the numbers show that they are now the largest lobbying force in Albany. They spend more money than anybody else, far more than the teachers union spends, although you'd never know that because the public narrative is that the big bad teachers union is running Albany and that legislators are doing what they're told, when in fact, really the education, the teachers that the union is busy defending are really sort of suffering at the hands of the charter school industry and the hedge fund people, and really education as we know it is seriously under attack.
And that it is. So we are going to end our conversation right now, and we are lucky enough to be joined on the telephone by Jimmy Vilkind, the Albany Bureau Chief of Capital New York, a publication that I read on a daily basis. I subscribe to their service and get an incredible amount of very useful information on a daily basis that gives me better eyes and ears into what's happening in Albany. So, Jimmy Vilkind, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks for having me. I'm sorry I didn't realize I was supposed to call in. My apologies, and happy to be with you.
That's quite all right, Jimmy. We'll forgive you any day of the week, so don't you worry about it.
This is Brian McDonald. I'd also like to welcome our guest to the People's Business. Before we dig into the substance about what's going on at the state legislature, and we certainly have a lot to talk about, can you tell us a little bit about Capital New York? It's a relatively new venture, but many of us who spend time in the walls of the Capitol are familiar with it. How large is your staff, and how are things going?
Well, up in Albany, we have 7 reporters. Most of us are detailed on a topic-specific beat. So we have a dedicated reporter for health, for education, for energy and the environment. And one of the things that I think really sets us apart is that as an all-digital outfit, we've been able to grow while some of the more traditional news outlets, including newspapers, have started to shrink a little bit. So Capital New York was launched in 2010 by two of my former editors at the New York Observer. But in 2013, it was bought by the same parent company as Politico.
Right.
And this fall, we're going to be rebranding as Politico New York, as Politico, the Washington, D.C.-based politics outlet, which, again, focuses online, expands both into Europe and, we hope, into other states in the U.S. as well. So New York is the first place where they've taken the Politico model and applied it on a state level. And we're excited that there will be more states to come.
Wow. You'd be able to read Jimmy Vilkind stories in Europe?
I sure hope so. I'm waiting for them to translate my stuff into Swedish.
All right.
Well, a large untapped market there.
Those same European friends of ours can listen to The People's Business on WRPI.org every day if they like. So I wanted to ask you, Jimmy, I mean, the elephant in the room right now. I mean, it's that Dean Skelos is out and John Flanagan is in. It's been a crazy 7 days. Since you know, we first heard about the charges against Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos, been a lot of jockeying going on for that leadership post between Senator DeFrancisco and Senator Flanagan. Maybe you've certainly been covering this very well and been very focused on this. I'm wondering, you know, what's your take on this? How did this all play out?
And there was essentially two candidates, John Flanagan, the Long Island candidate, and John DeFrancisco, the upstate candidate. And just basically, if you were to take a perfect regional split, you would have thought that DeFrancisco had the advantage. And indeed, when he walked in to the GOP conference on Monday morning, he said he believed he had the vote to secure the majority leader spot. But what we found out was that Flanagan had been quietly assembling a coalition and picking off key upstate supporters. So reportedly, Kathy Young and Mike Mazzolio, both of the Finger Lakes, Mazzolio of the Finger Lakes and Young of Chautauqua County and the Jamestown area, they were both supporters of John Flanagan. They were the furthest upstate West New York supporters that he received, as well as in the Capital Region, Hugh Farley, Jim Seward, who sort of has the Delaware County up through including Cooperstown, Eagle County there. And then in the Hudson Valley, Senators John Bonasek and Bill Larkin ended up supporting John Flanagan. So by doing that, he was able to get the votes that he needed, some 18 votes in the 33-member conference, and be victorious. And I also, you know, it's interesting in that there's sort of a split writ large in the Republican Party everywhere. And there are splits in the Democratic Party, too. But in the Republican Party, there's sort of a split between a more conservative, sort of populist, you know, arguably a Tea Party brand of Republican. And, you know, we really saw this manifested in Carl Paladino, 2010 gubernatorial candidate. We see it manifested now in some state legislators, guys like Assemblyman Steve McLaughlin or Claudia Tenney, the assemblywoman from Urban Utica. And then there's this more kind of mainstream pro-business, pro-growth. And in New York, where the Democrats are dominant, that tends to mean kind of go along, get along, cut a deal, do the best you can brand of Republican. And what we've seen is that the Long Island Republicans, and Flanagan, I believe, is going to continue this course, has certainly been in that latter category. And there was a lot of displeasure among some of the former category, and they really pushed hard for DeFrancisco. This really includes that it's for gun rights activists who are still angry over the 2013 gun control law, the STATE Act, that Cuomo pushed in the law and that the 9 Republican senators from Long Island all supported and that Dean Skelos went to the floor. And I think that they really felt that if Flanagan were to win as opposed to DeFrancisco, their shot at maybe trying to affect the legislative balance would be gone. And also from a purely parochial standpoint, whoever holds the Senate Majority Leader slot, you know, really, with that comes a lot of power to kind of direct funds and direct state attention. And we here in the Capital Region certainly saw that when Joe Bruno was the majority leader from 1994 until 2008.
That was a very thorough analysis, and I think that's a typical example of the kind of work that you do. I also have to tip my hat to you for the Guy Vilela reference. Well done. so that was the legendary Bronx politician who had the disagreement with prosecutors, and he was a larger-than-life force in Albany for many of us for many years. Jimmy, your publication is gaining prominence. I think the timing is extraordinary given the number of scandals that are taking place in Albany. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the product that you're involved with, how it's different from the traditional print media, and how the timing of all these scandals is helping or not helping? I'm going to start calling it political New York, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, sure. It's certainly never a dull time to be in Albany. I've been covering the Capitol since 2008, and on my second day of work, after the Democrats had won in that rare two-year period, a majority in the New York State Senate, things immediately began to start falling apart. So I don't want to say dysfunction, but sort of uncertainty and a little bit of chaos have been the norm for me in my time in Albany. And certainly here we're seeing it again with these this steady drumbeat of arrests. So Capital New York, many newspapers have a traditional subscription model where you pay to get the paper delivered at home or whatever. Capital New York actually has a sort of a digital subscription model where our subscribers get all of our content, including some of our exclusive content, immediately emailed to their inboxes whenever they post online. So if you're a professional who's on the go, if you're someone who wants to keep abreast of happenings both in Albany, in New York City Hall, also the media, or if you have topic-specific concerns related to healthcare, education, it's a good way to have the news kind of delivered to you. And you can customize what alerts you get so that you don't have to take time out of your day to go online and seek things out and check the blogs or check the newspapers, et cetera, et cetera. So it's sort of a new service that does all that for you if you're a subscriber. And for people who don't subscribe, there is some content that's available, including some of the higher-level analyses. But, it's a pretty robust program for those who do choose to subscribe, and we're happy to see the number of people who do so is growing.
Well, we're glad to hear that. I wanted to ask you, just to shift gears a little bit here, you recently went to Cuba. You followed the governor on his journey or trade mission or whatever you want, a goodwill mission to Cuba recently. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. That must have been a fascinating experience.
Oh, it was absolutely fascinating. So just to catch up listeners, Governor Cuomo, in this, his second term, said that he wants to go on trade missions overseas. And so he's planning trips to China, to Canada, to Mexico, to Italy. He's Italian, so he just wants to go to Italy. So there's so much trade we're going to do there. Also to Israel. But then once the Obama administration in December of last year announced that it was going to ease some of the restrictions that have really been in place since the Cold War, Cuomo said that he wanted to make a trip with officials from several New York businesses so that New York would be, quote, the first in line as restrictions are lifted, both on the Cuban side and on the American side. And so we went for, I think, 26 hours total on the ground. There were about, 20 or so business executives. The governor, some of his top cabinet officials were with him there on the trip, and a gaggle of we reporters in the Fourth Estate. And, it was really, really cool. So, one thing that really struck me about Cuba, what I saw, was that things were just kind of dingy and underdeveloped. You'd have these beautiful old buildings, but they hadn't really been properly maintained. We could see in some places people were living on the second floor of a building, but there was a piece of roof missing on the third floor. And it just seemed like an area where people where things were just a little bit run down. There wasn't a lot of activity going on. All the people that we met were very, very, very friendly. The people I spoke to said that they liked Americans, they wanted more Americans to go. But at the same time, you could see, the evidence of a regime that was fairly repressive. There was propaganda in the street, as we all think about the old stereotypes. And one of the signs we saw was them saying that the embargo, which they call el bloque, was the longest genocide in history. and so, know, that is the official Cuban line. We had a local guide, and I'm making air quotes around local guide because I assume he was a Cuban government minder, but a very nice young man named Christopher who showed us around. And one thing that he said was that, that the Cubans believe that the American embargo is really to blame for their economic suffering. And so that seems to be the party line there. But there, people are very hopeful that as restrictions ease, that their standard of living might rise up a bit. So, you know, it was a very fascinating point in time to go and to be able to see things. And Cuomo made that point. You know, but it was an interesting idea for the governor of New York to make the trip, because as we know, a lot of the policies in question here are federal policies. So Congress will theoretically have to repeal or tweak some provisions of the Torricelli Act or the Helms-Burton Act, both of which were passed during the 1990s and really put the force of law behind some of the sanctions that, again, date back to not just the Kennedy administration, but the Eisenhower administration, right after the successful coup against the Batista government in Cuba. What will Andrew Cuomo impact on that? And so the governor was talking about how he was happy to be an advocate. I was a spokesman, how he believed the blockade was a bad idea. But it seemed to me, at least, that there's a little bit of an element of, well, the joke's on you Cubans. You've got this guy here. He's saying all the right things, but he has the power to deliver absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. from a political point of view, of course, Andrew Cuomo looks leaderly. It is an opportunity for him to bulk up his international credentials should he maybe try to become a national political figure. It doesn't seem he's going to run for president in 2016 unless an asteroid were to come out of the sky and, maybe take out leading Democratic contenders, about five or six of them, before Cuomo would sort of jump to the front of the line. But we don't know what his future holds, and he doesn't know what his future holds. And all the political scientists say, on the long run, doing something like this is just good. It bolsters his credentials. Mm. And, of course, Cuomo's immediate stated justification was business and making business connections. Since the trip, we've announced that JetBlue, the New York-based airline, is offering regular charter service from JFK Airport to Havana. That's something that Cuomo and JetBlue officials who were on this trade mission talked about as an explicit goal. There was also a partnership announced between the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo and the Genomics Research Center in Cuba to help work on and develop a lung vaccine. And, there were other businesses who made some contact to try and sell their goods in Cuba, again, if restrictions are lifted or if a market can be found.
You didn't happen to notice any Startup New York ads playing while you were watching TV down there, did you?
No, I didn't notice any.
I didn't know if they reached there yet.
Jimmy, you said you started reporting in 2008. Now, that's really been a time of great turmoil in the state. You had Senator Bruno moving on, Governor Spitzer moving on. But I want to ask you about this governor specifically. How would you compare this term? I mean, it's early in the second term, but to the first term. In my opinion, it seemed that the media was very reluctant to take on the governor in the first term. Now it seems like there's a different attitude by the press. Not that they're disrespectful towards the governor, but they're willing to push the administration off its narrative a little bit more than they were 4 years ago. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think that when everyone comes in, they start off with the benefit of the doubt, be they a gubernatorial administration or a new legislator or a new player on the political scene. And I think that over time that we in the press have seen a pattern emerge for Andrew Cuomo. He's always someone who makes the deal, and he's always someone who will sort of take sometimes a half-loaf measure that many people will criticize. We've seen that he's become very, very controlling in the way he runs government, both in the operation of state agencies. We in the press see it most tangibly in trying to get information about the government from the various state agencies. I think that over time there's become something of a level of distrust. But I also think, Brian, that part of the change in tone you're seeing is the result of the last election. And it's also a result not just of the press's attitude, but sort of the general attitude and posture of the body politic. You know, in the first term, legislators, both Republicans and Democrats, were loath to take on Governor Cuomo, were loath to criticize his program. And I think you saw them essentially swallow some measures that he pushed that I think were surprising to a lot of us. The governor had tremendous leverage over rank-and-file legislators with respect to redistricting in 2012. And he was able to take that and trade it for some reductions in pensions for newly hired state workers that, you know, many people would have considered to be an utter non-starter, particularly among rank-and-file Democratic legislators. And so, over time, we saw, going through this election, a fairly serious challenge on the governor's left flank by Zephyr Teachout and by Howie Hawkins. Zephyr Teachout in the Democratic primary, and almost in a general election bid as she tried to gain the nomination of the Working Families Party. And she was unsuccessful about that. We can talk more about that, even though it seems like it's so long ago now. So I think that what emerged is a governor who did not get elected by a very sound and resounding margin. I think it was about 54%.
54%.
They have shifted a little bit since I last had them in my head. What we've seen is now a new crop of legislators, because we've seen both Senator Skelos now removed from leadership and longtime Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver sort of ousted from his leadership. And we've seen this shadow of corruption that I think has hurt Cuomo tangibly and intangibly. We don't know if he will be charged. We have reason to believe that prosecutors are sort of looking at his administration, how it interacted with some pretty big donors in the state, how it handled the Moreland Commission to investigate public corruption, which Cuomo convened in the summer of 2013 and then was party to its negotiation out of existence in March of 2014. And so I think that has certainly drawn the attention of prosecutors from the Southern District. And so I think that this idea, in 2010, Cuomo ran as the anti-corruption candidate, the person who was going to change Albany. And I think 4 years later, a lot of voters are starting to think, well, you know, you haven't really been this white knight. You know, you have your strengths as a governor. You've pushed for policies that I think a majority of voters in many cases like. He's presided over a minimum wage increase. He presided over an income tax cut for middle-class people, as well as renewing most of an income tax surcharge on the wealthy that had been set to expire in 2011. And he pushed for and won same-sex marriage. Again, polls show this is popular. He pushed for a tough gun control law, again, something that is very popular with the majority of New Yorkers, though there are some stark regional divides on that.
Right. I think there's no question he's been pushing things through. We only got a minute left here, Jimmy, and I just wanted to ask you one quick question, without elaborating too much. You know, we have a weak governor. We've got a new Senate majority leader. We've got a relatively new assembly speaker. What's going to get done at the end of this session? Is anything going to happen? I mean, we still have rent regs. We've got tax cap. Give us 30 seconds on what you think is going to happen at the end of session.
You know, I think that there's a big cloud of uncertainty, particularly over the real estate issues, because, as I said, the federal prosecutors who are looking into it have now taken as a cooperating witness a top executive at a big real estate company that's the state's biggest political donor. So I think there might be a movement among political leaders to say, hey, you know, let's extend everything 1 year and let's deal with this another time.
That's probably a reasonable assumption. Well, Jimmy, I hate to cut you off. I could talk to you all day and sometimes do. But this is The People's Business on WRPI and Troy, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee and part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Ron Deutsch, the Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. I've been joined by Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director. We miss you, Frank Morrow, and we will see you next time. Jimmy, Andy, thank you so much for being our guests. And we now stay tuned for Democracy Now!
Thank you, Jimmy.